The last talk that I gave a couple of months ago, I began by quoting something Joseph Campbell said, the scholar of mythology. He made the point that a lot of the problems that occur in religion are because people take metaphors literally. He said, quote, "Every religion is true one way or another when understood metaphorically, but when it gets stuck in its own metaphors, taking them as facts, then that's when you get in trouble." And I think he's onto something really important there. And an even better, sort of blunter version of that is by the New Testament scholar, John Dominic Crossan, who I also quoted. "My point," he said, "is not that those ancient people told literal stories and were now smart enough to take them symbolically, but that they told them symbolically and we are now dumb enough to take them literally." Wow. I think that's a real challenge to the way that most people, most of us, understand religion. And in particular, I think it's a challenge to this really important concept, maybe the most important, the idea of transcendence, right? If you think about religion, for so many people, what that involves is the possibility, maybe the promise, that after we die, if we believe what we're told to believe and do what we're told, that we might qualify for some afterlife, maybe a heaven, you know, with eternal life in heaven with God, something like that. And for Buddhism too, you know, there's the idea of we can be we are reborn after we die, physically die. That's the way it's usually understood. And, you know, depending on our karma, it can be better or worse than our lifetime here. And that the idea of nirvana is somehow the end of that rebirth. And it's kind of vague. It's really, there's a lot of ambiguity in the concept, but it definitely involves the end of rebirth into this world with some implication. It would seem that there is some sort of other reality that one is experiencing. But it's really interesting that Nagarjuna, who in my opinion, and I think in the opinion of many, is really the second most important person in the Buddhist tradition after the Buddha himself, you know, the great, great philosopher. He's well known for saying that nirvana is not some other reality. In fact, samsara is nirvana. Samsara, that is to say, this world of suffering, craving, delusion is nirvana, what we're seeking, the Buddhist goal. Actually, he didn't say that. He said something a little bit different. He said that the koti, that's the Sanskrit word, which means something like the place, the limits, the zone, the sphere. Basically, the place that is samsara is not different than the place that is nirvana. In other words, what he seems to be pointing to is that the goal of the religious life, the religious practice, it's not about transcending this world, but actually coming to experience it in a different way. In other words, what we need to transcend is not, you know, this reality, but realize that we have always been experiencing it in a certain kind of way, limited way, and that there's another way to experience it. And this is where the concept of non-duality comes in, because one of the most important ways to characterize that difference between our usual way of experiencing this world and the alternative that Buddhism and other spiritual traditions are pointing at. One of the main ways to characterize that difference is that our usual way of experiencing is dualistic, which in this context means there's the sense of a self, right? There's a me that's in the world, and the world is outside myself, and all of you and everything and the rest of the world is outside. So there's this duality of inside and outside, of self and other. And as Thich Nhat Hanh put it, we are here to awaken from the illusion of our separateness. You could say, from the illusion of our duality, that we are separate from other people and from the rest of the world. I mean, actually, non-duality means a lot of different things, which is why whenever you read or hear the term, it's really important to ask yourself, well, non-duality literally means not two, right? So it's always a denial of duality. And so it's important to ask, you know, what is the duality that's being denied? And in some spiritual traditions, you know, they'll say, well, it's all one, which is actually not that common in Buddhism, by the way. Or another type of non-duality, which is important in Buddhism, is the non-duality of bipolar thinking. That is to say, avoiding the kind of thinking that gets us caught up in bipolar opposites, where, you know, we want one and we don't want the other, but in fact, you can't have that. To give the example of, say, pure and impure, that's a good example. Basically, it seems like we have two concepts, but in fact, they're two sides of the same concept, really, in that the meaning of each is the negation of the other, right? So the problem with bipolar thinking is when we want the one and don't want the other. And in the case of this example, it means that if you want to live a pure life, it means you're going to be preoccupied with avoiding impurity, because purity is simply, right, the avoiding the impurity. And you're kind of caught up in a duality there, maybe having to evaluate every situation you find yourself in and say, you know, is this is my response pure? Is it impure? And that is an example of how we can bind ourselves, you know, without a rope, in the sense that we get caught up in kind of a head trip. Why one of the great Chan or Zen masters said, true purity is to live beyond the duality of purity and impurity. Anyway, there's a lot more that could be said about bipolar thinking, especially if we wanted to look at the problem of good and evil, which is maybe the most important example. But what I really want to focus on now is this non-duality of self and other, of subject and object. There are many ways this non-duality has been expressed in the traditions, and not just Buddhism. One version that I'm very fond of quoting, and apologies if you've heard it too often from me, but the Neo-Vedantin, the Hindu teacher Nisargadatta, I think expressed it very well when he said, expressed this non-duality when he said, when I look inside and see that I am nothing, that is wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that is love. Between these two, my life flows. That's a really good example of it. Within the Buddhist tradition, maybe the best version I know is from Dogen. You know, Dogen actually talked about how we can experience non-duality, and how the practice involves letting go of the sense of self in order that we can experience our intimacy with all things, as he put it. So Dogen most famously said, right, to study the Buddha Dharma, study in the sense of, you know, inquire into, to study the Buddha Dharma is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self, to let go of the self, we might say. And to forget the self is to realize our intimacy with the 10,000 things, or sometimes translated, you know, to realize our non-duality with the rest of the world, right? And then later, Dogen beautifully, in describing his own experience as a result of this letting go of the sense of self, he quoted a Chinese master who said, I came to realize clearly that mind is nothing other than rivers and mountains and the great wide earth, the sun and the moon and the stars. In other words, my mind isn't somehow in here looking at an objective external world, but there's the kind of a conflation, the non-duality between them. And actually, you know, once you start to look for this, it's amazing how often you find this in many spiritual traditions. Of course, as one would expect, primarily in the more mystical thinkers. For example, Advaita Vedanta, which is, you know, one of the most prominent Hindu philosophies. Advaita literally means non-dual, by the way. And that tradition especially is sort of essential. The non-duality is essential to the Upanishads, which were developing around the same time as the Buddha lived. And for example, there's one Isa Upanishad, which quotes it really well. Let's see if I can find it quickly enough here. Yeah, the Isa Upanishad. To the seer, all things have truly become the self. What delusion, what sorrow can there be for him who beholds that oneness? Mm-hmm. Everything has become the self. It's quite striking. In Vedanta, especially Advaita Vedanta, they don't use Buddhist language. Buddhist language, we're always talking about no self, letting go of the self. In Vedanta, they're always talking about the self, but I think it really amounts to the same thing. There are different ways of letting go of the duality. In other words, Buddhism says there's no self, there's just the non-duality, and Vedanta says that there's only the self. They love to talk about the self, but you know, then they're denying that there's an objective world that's separate from the self. But whether you take away the self or take away the objective world, and basically what it seems to me is going on is they are alternative sort of ways to describe the non-dual experience. And you find them in many other traditions as well. I'm just going to read a couple quotations, one of them from the great Taoist Chuangzi. And by the way, I might as well give a plug to my book while we're at it here, because most of what I have to say is taken from this book on non-duality and Buddhism and beyond. Chuangzi says beautifully, if there is no other, then there will be no I. If there is no I, well, then there's no one to make distinctions. The self is also the other. The other is also the self. When self and other lose their opposition, then we have the very essence of the Tao. So, unsurprisingly, this emphasis on non-duality is very important in the traditions that I think we can call non-dual. But even in theistic traditions, again, especially among the mystics within those traditions, you find very strong statements of this. For example, the great Rumi, Sufi within the Islamic tradition, he has a little poem called, well, the title that I know is called The Worm Awakens. Let me just quote it. This is how a human being can change. There's a worm addicted to eating grape leaves. Suddenly, he wakes up. Call it grace, whatever. Something wakes him. And he's no longer a worm. He's the entire vineyard and the orchard too, the fruit, the trunks. A growing wisdom and joy that doesn't need to devour. He's no longer a worm. He's the entire vineyard. And perhaps the greatest of the Sufi philosophers, Ibn Arabi, expressed it more philosophically, of course. Quote, then when you see what is around you is not other than you, and all and everything as the existence of the one, in this case they are referring to the one, when you do not see anything else with him or in him, but see him in everything as yourself, and at the same time as the non-existence of the self. Then what you see is the truth. Meister Eckhart, the great medieval Christian mystic, famously said, the eye that I see God with is the same eye that God sees me with. And again, what's striking about the theistic way of understanding non-duality is that they say to experience non-dually is to experience the true nature of God. It's to realize our unity with God, because that's the kind of language that they use. But I think they're pointing to the same kind of experience. Now, admittedly, that's intriguing, but it all seems kind of strange. And can we get more of a handle on it? Can we get a sense of what that experience might be like? And that's what I want to spend the rest of my time on, is sort of trying to communicate what the experience of non-duality might be. I want to start with something that Joanna Macy said, describing an experience that she had when she was sitting on a train in India. I was sitting on a train when it happened and reading a book on Buddhism. And sitting there in that crowded train with all its heat and smell, suddenly it was utterly self-evident that I did not exist in the way I thought I did. Interesting. It became evident. It's like it's realizing what's always been the case. It's not gaining something new. And this realization brought with it the experience, which I can only describe as a kernel of popcorn popping. Pop. I can't say I've ever heard the popcorn kernel before. But then she goes on to say, it was as though the inside came out on the outside. And I think from a, you know, basically, if you think about what Buddhism is saying, if there's no self inside, then the outside, then there's no outside, because the outside isn't outside, right? And I looked with wonder and joy at everything, and the sense then was of unutterable relief of, I don't need to do anything with the self. I don't need to improve it or make it good or sacrifice it or crucify it. I don't need to do anything because it isn't even there. And with that release came at once, immediately, there was an immense feeling of release. And with that release came at once, immediately, a feeling that it was release into action. Again, the sense of release. I mean, in Zen, in Buddhism, we often talk about enlightenment or realization, but within the Buddhist, within the Indian traditions, there's very much emphasis on liberation, right? In this case, liberation, release, freedom from the delusion of self and all that that entails. Now, Joanna's experience, she's focusing on the lack of no self, the sort of disappearance of our usual sense of separate self. But she hasn't said, she doesn't say there much about the outside. And so what I'd like to do is talk a little bit. I mean, I think, in fact, often many of us have had some taste of what we might call non-dual experience. And I want to talk about it in terms of perception, what non-dual perception might be like, what it might be like to act non-dually, and also what it would mean to think non-dually. So let me just take those one by one and to sort of talk a little bit about them. When it comes to non-dual perception, I think the easiest to understand, and maybe, you know, many of us have had a taste of this at one time or other, is non-dual hearing, non-dual sound. In my own case, I've had the experience, not often, but when it does happen, it is truly wonderful. Music, I mean, I love music, so I'll listen to music a lot when I can. And sometimes, and it's often like at night, maybe when my wife is gone, so I can jack up the sound a little bit and I don't worry about the neighbors or whatever. And something really very odd happens where I forget the sense of separation. It's like the sense of a me that's hearing the sound that is outside me. I become absorbed into the music and I'm experiencing the music in kind of a non-dual way. Actually, T.S. Eliot talks about this. I think it's in the one of the four quartets where he says, quote, "Music heard so deeply that there is no music, but you are the music while it lasts." I expect many of us have sort of had a taste of that at one time or other, even if we didn't really sort of understand what was going on. In my own case, it can go on for quite a while, but then at a certain point, there's this kind of slipping back or back into duality in the sense that I become aware, the thoughts recur. I become aware of how much I'm enjoying the music. And the act of that awareness sort of dualizes me at that point. Then I kind of fall out of the non-duality of the music. When I become aware of myself as enjoying the music, then at that point I've sort of fallen back into duality. But it's interesting. There's one of the great Japanese Zen masters of our time, Yasutani. He talked about this as Kensho. Let's see. This is an excerpt from one of his private interviews with Westerners, and he's talking about what is it like to experience Kensho. Quote, "There's a line a famous Zen master wrote at the time he became enlightened, which reads, 'When I heard the temple bell ring, suddenly there was no bell and no I, just sound.' In other words, he was no longer aware of a distinction between himself, the bell, the sound, and the universe. This is the state you have to reach. Kensho, self-realization, is the direct awareness that you are more than this puny body or limited mind. Stated negatively, it's the realization that the universe is not external to you. Positively, it's experiencing the universe as yourself, experiencing the universe non-dually. But what about seeing? I mean, hearing, I think it's easier. Seeing seems more dualistic, right? In that I think it's less easy, less common, and maybe more difficult to understand what non-dual seeing might be like. But let me quote something from Krishnamurti, an experience he had when he was 28 years old. He described the experience in a letter that he wrote 2 days after it, and it's quite suggestive. "Then on the 17th of August, I felt acute pain at the nape of my neck, and I had to cut down my meditation. But the pain, instead of getting better, as I hoped, it just grew worse. I couldn't think, wasn't able to do anything, and then friends forced me to retire to bed. Then I became almost unconscious, though I was well aware of what was happening around me. I came to myself at about noon each day, and on the first day, when I was in that state, I had the first most extraordinary experience." And here he goes. "There was a man mending the road. That man was myself. The pickaxe he held was myself. The very stone which he was breaking up was a part of me. The tender blade of grass was my very being, and the tree beside the man was myself. I almost could feel and think like the road mender, and I could feel the wind passing through the tree and the little ant on the blade of grass. I could feel. The birds, the dust, and the very noise were a part of me. Just then, there was a car passing by at some distance. I was the driver, the engine, and the tires. As the car went further away from me, I was going away from myself. I was in everything, or rather, everything was in me, inanimate and animate, the mountain, the worm, and all breathing things." Reminding me again of Dogen, right? "I came to realize mind is nothing other than rivers and mountains, the sun and the moon and the stars." There's another quotation that I think is also very another experience by the English cleric, the 17th century English cleric Thomas Traherne, which was published in his book Centuries of Meditations. And what's interesting about it, notice the emphasis on luminosity. It's going to start a little bit oddly, but once it gets to the non-duality, I think it's really, really striking, okay? So here we go. Quote, "The dust and stones of the street were as precious as gold. The gates were at first the end of the world." So he's talking about suddenly he's experiencing this village where he lives in a very different way. "The green trees, when I saw them first through one of the gates, transported me. Their sweetness and unusual beauty made my heart to leap and almost mad with ecstasy. They were such strange and wonderful things. And young men glittering and sparkling angels, boys and girls tumbling in the street and playing were moving jewels. I knew not that they were born or should die. Eternity was manifest in the light of the day, and something infinite behind everything appeared." We're going to come back to that. "Something infinite behind everything appeared." All right, I'm reminded of Blake. If the door, William Blake, "If the doors of perception were cleansed, we would see everything as it is, infinite. Something infinite behind everything appeared, which talked with my expectation and moved my desire. The city seemed to stand in Eden or to be built in heaven. The streets were mine, the temple was mine, the people were mine, their clothes in gold and silver were mine, as much as their sparkling eyes, fair skins, and ruddy faces. The skies were mine, and so were the sun and the moon and the stars, and all the world was mine, and I the only spectator and enjoyer of it. So that with much ado I was corrupted and made to learn the dirty devices of this world." He fell back, you could say, into duality, "which I now unlearn and become, as it were, a little child again, so that I may enter into the kingdom of God." Notice the emphasis on luminosity, and I think that's really important, because you know, really, the reality is our eyes do not see things. The eyes, what do they see? They see light. And then in the brain, the light is kind of structured and organized, and we see the world as a collection of separate objects. But in a way, there's kind of deconstructing, and they're going back to the luminosity, you know, what he's alluding to, this luminosity of the world. And that reminds me of the Tibetan teacher Treleg Rinpoche, who again expressed something like, you know, that incredible line, "Eternity was manifest in the light of the day, and something infinite behind everything appeared." Treleg says, "Appearance is a funny sort of word. It means some kind of surface thing, but with something else called reality that's behind it." That's the way we normally understand it. Something, presence, that's the word he prefers. Presence is a much better word. Something is presenting by itself, whose essence is emptiness. What appears is the phenomenal world, but it's empty because it has no real substance. And it's interesting to me, you know, the original Sanskrit term, shunyata, which we usually, that's the term we usually translate as emptiness. People now, some people are referring to talk about it as boundlessness or unlimitedness. Again, something infinite, something, in other words, what's behind the appearance is not an objective, external, fixed thing, but that the what we normally call an appearance is a presencing of something, and that's what one is getting a sense of. One is experiencing the world as this luminous presencing. And then Treleg goes on to say, "In keeping with that, we no longer make a distinction between subject and object. Because when we reflect on our own experiences properly, we see things are not really presented to experience as solid entities, and we're not solid entities either. What we experience as other and what we experience as self are not completely distanced or separate from each other. So I think that's a kind of a, I mean, I just find that very suggestive. The idea, not only the non-dual hearing, as heck can happen with the music, but seeing in a more non-dual luminous way, where when we forget ourselves, we see everything as ourselves, and everything is this luminous emptiness. But what about non-dual action? Is there such a thing as that? Is there always a sense of self when we're doing something? And this, very importantly, this refers to a very major concept in Taoism, right? The Chinese tradition of Taoism. This concept of wei wu wei, literally the action of no action. And sometimes that's understood as like, you know, the action, you don't really need to do anything. Things will take care of themselves. But that's really missing the essential point. The action of non-action is the action without a sense of the self that's doing it, in which case there's a sense of effortlessness and peace in the action itself. That's, in other words, it's how the action is experienced when there's no sense of self that's doing it. And again, I think we have some taste of this, or at least some people do. We hear, for example, about athletes, you know, who somehow something happens and they're in the zone. Maybe they score 60 points in a basketball game or something like that, or they're running a long distance race and they kind of forget themselves in the race, and the body, it's not as though that they're, you know, forcing the body, making the body to move in a certain way, but the body sort of takes on a life of its own. You know, again, there's not that sense of a duality, of a sense of self that has to push or control or make the body do something. It takes on this life of its own. Playing music, I think, can be an example of that. The really great musicians, if they're so good with their instrument, they can really forget themselves and become spontaneous, and it can take on, again, a life of its own. There's not that sense of control and effort. Now, someone like myself trying to play the piano, that's simply not possible. But somebody who has mastered that kind of skill can do so. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, I don't know how to say it. He has a book called The Evolving Self, where he alludes to this. He says, we forget ourselves and become lost in the activity. Often we feel a sense of transcendence, as if the boundaries of the self had been expanded. Non-dual action, right? But what about thinking? Is there such a thing as non-dual thinking? In a way, that might be the most difficult of all, because if you think about it, I mean, usually when we're meditating, we're sort of treating thoughts and other things that come up in the mind as sort of things to let go of. In other words, it seems like thoughts are part of the problem. And indeed, sometimes in Zen, certainly I've noticed sometimes we sort of shade over, fall into that, the idea that, you know, the ideal mind is the mind that doesn't have any thoughts at all. But in fact, I think that's a really serious misunderstanding of the tradition, that the point of our path is not to get rid of thinking, but to think more deeply, to think more creatively. And that's, I think, what it really means to think non-dually. As the French writers put it, Lamartine, he said, I never think, my thoughts think for me. And there are so many examples of this. As someone who loves classical music, I'm especially aware of those. And the composers themselves often say that this is how they compose. And so they're the ones who sort of give us accounts of how the music can actually write itself, except sometimes they'll talk about God, because there's a sense of, you know, there's a kind of letting go of the self, but there's an openness for something to present it. For example, Richard Strauss, quote, referring to the composition of one of his operas, "While the ideas were flowing in upon me, the entire musical Measure by Measure, I was definitely conscious of being aided by more than an earthly power." Again, using sort of more theistic, more sort of spiritual language. Puccini said, "The music of Madame Butterfly was dictated to me by God. I was merely instrumental in putting it on paper and communicating it to the public." Johannes Brahms said, "When I feel the urge, I begin the urge to write music. I begin by appealing directly to my maker," right? Capital M, God. "I immediately feel vibrations which thrill my whole being. And then I feel capable of drawing inspiration from above. The vibrations assume the form of distinct mental images. The ideas flow upon me direct from God. And not only do I see distinct themes, but they're clothed in the right forms, harmonies, and orchestration. Measure by measure, the finished product is revealed to me when I am in those rare, inspired moods." Again, non-dual, inspiration. We hear a lot about inspiration. And I think, is that just another way of talking about these things just kind of pop into our mind? They're not things that we laboriously work out, but they spontaneously spring up. Stravinsky, "I heard and I wrote what I heard. I am the vessel through which the rite of spring passed." Kazintsintsmihalyi, again, that same guy who has an unpronounceable last name, he quoted a well-known composer. I'm not sure which one it was. Quote, "You are in an ecstatic state to such a point that you feel as though you almost don't exist. I've experienced this time and again. My hand..." "seems devoid of myself, and I have nothing to do with what's happening." Again, no self, right? "I just sit there watching it in a state of awe and wonderment, and the music just flows out by itself." Makes me wonder about Beethoven. Beethoven became deaf very early in his career, and so he couldn't hear anything. And I just wonder if that contributed, as somebody who, by the time he went deaf, sort of knew music well. He could hear everything in his mind, but because he was less distracted by, the normal sounds, whether that, made the inspiration deeper and more likely for him. But here's the other thing, music is one example, and in some ways maybe the best example, but lots of other examples too. For example, drawing. I think many of us are familiar with the Swiss graphic artist Escher, who said, while drawing, I feel as if I were a spiritualistic medium controlled by the creatures I'm conjuring up. And it is as if they themselves decide on the shape in which they would like to appear. One of my favorite writers, the Argentinian writer, Jorge Luis Borges, he writes these lovely little short sort of kind of philosophical fantasies. He also said, "I don't write what I want. I don't choose my subjects or plots. They're given to me. I have to stand back and receive them in a passive moment." And then returning to William Blake, I quoted him earlier, right, if the doors of perception were cleansed. But he talked about the way that he composed, and he said, "I have written this poem," he's referring to his long poem called Milton, "I have written this poem from immediate dictation." It's as if God's dictating it to him. "From immediate dictation, 12 or sometimes even 20 or 30 lines at a time, without premeditation, and even against my will." Against my will. In other words, he didn't want to do it, but he felt that he had to. And maybe it's appropriate here just to mention a few of my own experiences here with I expect I do what many of you also do, in the sense that I do keep a pad and a pen by my bed. And it's interesting how sometimes late at night, when I'm just kind of lying there, and especially if I've been sort of working on something difficult and thinking about something, I'm just kind of lying there and falling into that sort of intermediate state before I actually fall asleep. And then, it's, you know, some thought comes to mind. And I have to write it down. I know if I don't write it down, it'll be gone in the morning. But and once in a while, the same thing will happen in the morning. If there's, like, if I'm waking up slowly and there's something kind of in the back of the mind, sometimes there'll be a kind of a creative thought that will come to mind. And I think that's an example, a little taste of non-dual thinking. But the most the most interesting experience I had of this was, you know, many years ago when I was reading everything I could on death, not only Zen and Buddhism, but other religions, philosophy, psychology. I was very preoccupied with that, and I was very taken, especially with Ernest Becker's book, The Denial of Death, which is quite amazing. And as I was reading this, I had the sense that something was brewing inside me, that there was something wanting to come out. And what finally happened, I sat down. I still remember, it was pretty much winter, but there was a lot of sun coming through the window. And I sat down at a table to write something else. And suddenly it felt almost as if a kind of dam had burst. And I suddenly just started writing down these thoughts. And as quickly as I wrote down one thought, another thought would come. And it went on. Actually, I was by myself then. I think Linda was maybe visiting her mother. I was able to sort of focus on this in a way for a couple days. And there was all this sort of thoughts coming to mind. And then when the thoughts kind of slowed down, I reread what I had written. And that brought up more thoughts. And by the end of 3 days, basically, I had the outline for a book. Something that I had no idea for, you know, a week earlier, but somehow it's just sort of, it was ready to happen, a kind of super saturation point from all the reading. I mean, and the reason I emphasize that is not to talk about my experience as being so unique. I think it may be a bit of an extreme example, but I think here too, you know, many of us have had these tastes of inspiration, these experiences, that this is the real meaning of creativity, where things sort of pop up by themselves. And I think it's important to, you know, acknowledge this is, it's not their sense of a self that's laboriously sort of doing it. It's not logic, but somehow it springs up by itself. As Lamartine said, the thoughts think for me. So, non-dual perception, hearing non-dually, we had some examples of that. The Wei Wu Wei of non-dual action, becoming completely one with what you're doing, losing your sense of self in the process. And likewise, non-dual thinking, which I think is really very much at the heart of what we normally describe as creativity. So, to conclude here, by emphasizing non-dual experience, I think it's important to acknowledge that the goal isn't simply to live non-dually in the sense of be totally absorbed into that world. I mean, in order to function day by day, you know, we also need a sense of self. The problem is that normally we have this dualistic sense of self that we've acquired as we grow up, as we're socialized, as we learn to use language and so forth. And we just assume that that's the way the world is. And the important thing about what I've been talking about is that it's possible to transcend this usual dualistic way of experiencing the world and experience the world in a very different way. And I think you could say the goal is to be able to sort of flow back and forth from one to the other, from the phenomenal to the essential, as we would say, from the dualistic to the non-dual, being comfortable in both dimensions, and then throughout one's practice, sort of more and more integrating the two. Please note, though, the other thing about these kind of non-dual experiences, I've offered a kind of metaphorical understanding of transcendence here, right? It's not about transcending this reality, but transcending our usual experience. I want to emphasize that what I've said doesn't imply anything one way or the other about what happens after we die. It's not to assert that we're only material, physical. It's not to claim that we are or are not reborn in some fashion. That's kind of all, you know, agnostic, but that's still a matter of faith in Buddhism or Christianity, whatever, for those who want to go there. But in any case, I think it's really important to have some of this kind of non-dual experience, which is so very sort of liberating and exhilarating. Let me end. I just want to quote a little bit of a favorite poem of mine by David White called Everything is Waiting for You. And I think what I've been talking about kind of offers a nice little slant on that and vice versa. So just a few lines from that poem. Your great mistake is to act the drama as if you were alone. To feel abandoned is to deny the intimacy of your surroundings. Remember Dogen, right? To forget yourself is to realize your intimacy with all things. To feel abandoned is to deny the intimacy of your surroundings. Surely, even you at times have felt the grand array, the swelling presence, and the chorus crowding out your solo voice. You must note the way the soap dish enables you or the window latch grants you freedom. Alertness is the hidden discipline of familiarity. Put down the weight of your aloneness and ease into the conversation. The kettle is singing even as it pours you a drink. The cooking pots have left their arrogant aloofness and seen the good in you at last. All the birds and creatures of the world are unutterably themselves. Everything is waiting for you. Everything, it's waiting for us.